Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, happy January 6th, fifth year anniversary. Feels like just yesterday you and I were rampaging through the Capitol.
Yeah.
Taking shits behind Pelosi's desk or whatever we were doing.
Still haven't found Mike Pence.
Yeah. We've been looking for that guy for 5 years. Yeah,
still can't identify him.
We recorded Pod Save America yesterday. We had a whole like editorial meeting to think about like what else we should cover besides Venezuela. Not one of us didn't even occur to us that the episode was going to be coming out on the January 6th anniversary. Maybe that's, is that a good thing? I don't know. No, it's probably not a good thing.
It's probably not a good thing. Yeah. Meanwhile, I got between our last podcast and this one, I got like this devastating flu. So I was basically like hallucinating through the first 48 hours of the post-Maduro Venezuela regime, but I'm here. I'm on the mend, Tommy.
This is your Jordan flu game.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not there in person though. But you don't want this.
So Ben's healing himself exclusively with essential oils, like any good LA West Sider.
I did my own research. RFK. I got a bunch of home cures. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you look good. I'm glad you feel better. The flu is the absolute worst. I got a flu shot over the break. I went with my 3-year-old to the pediatrician, and I had to show her that I was brave and get the flu shot first, which did not feel great, to be honest with you. Then she got it, and then we got ice cream. And I let her eat the ice cream before we had lunch. So it was honestly,
well, we had a really good time. My kids are older and it still works. Ice cream still works.
Chocolate with sprinkles, baby. Yeah. All right, we got a great show today. We're going to focus just on three big topics. So the first is the latest from Venezuela. We're going to talk about the backstory about how Trump got from negotiations to invasion, why he jettisoned opposition leader Maria Machado and embraced Delcy Rodriguez, who is Maduro's handpicked vice president. Then we're going to go deeper on the so-called Dunroe Doctrine. We're going to explore what Trump's newfound love for regime change and expansionist foreign policy at gunpoint might mean for the world. So that's a fun one for everyone to figure out. And then finally, we're going to cover these massive protests that we've seen in Iran for well over a week now that appear to pose the most serious threat to the regime since, I don't know, probably 2009, Ben. I mean, 2022 were the last protests of this scale, but it feels like 2009 was the most significant in terms of threat to the establishment there. So there's a lot of people who are watching this closely. And then Ben, you just did our interview. Who are folks going to hear from?
Yeah, I talked to Joaquin Castro, a Democrat, a member of the House from San Antonio, who's also the ranking Democrat on the House subcommittee that deals with the Western Hemisphere. So he's kind of the senior guy dealing with this region. We talked about his reaction to the operation in Venezuela, Congress's role or lack thereof in terms of how they found out about this, his effort that he's engaging with Thomas Massie and Jim McGovern to pass a war powers resolution that would kind of compel Trump to come back to Congress, not just on use of force in Venezuela, but Greenland, Mexico, the other places,
That'd be nice.
And just kind of where this is all going and what Democrats are saying about it, what Republicans are saying about it, what his constituents are saying about it. So it was a good conversation with Joaquin.
Great. That's great. A very important piece of this. I'm excited to hear that. I also did want to just say thank you to everybody who listened to our bonus podcast from Saturday. Ben, we hit number 4 in the Apple rankings of the top podcast episodes, which means we at least temporarily were beating Ben Shapiro, Tucker Carlson, NPR, and even the juggernaut that is Pardon My Take, my favorite sports podcast.
What about Candace? Did we catch up to Candace now?
She was probably accusing someone of having a dick, so I don't know if we beat her. But it was great. It means a lot to us. If you're watching this on YouTube, please subscribe to Pod Save the World on YouTube. If you're listening to it as a podcast, please, if you could go from casual listener to subscriber, it really helps the show. It's also free. Also, if you're a super fan of Crooked Media or Pod Save the World, or you generally just want to help out progressive independent media, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to crooked.com/friends. You get ad-free episodes, tons of bonus content. But also, it's the number one thing you could do to help us reduce our dependence on these big tech platforms and build a media company. So thanks for listening. All right, let's get to the show, Ben. So we're going to kind of tick through some of the stuff we've learned about the Venezuela operation since Saturday when we recorded that breaking news episode. Let's start with some of the things we learned about the operation itself. We'll get to the evolution of the policy and then how Trump decided to jettison the duly elected opposition and back the regime in the form of Delcy Rodriguez, Maduro's handpicked VP. But first, here's just a little bit of Trump talking about the Venezuela operation during a speech this morning, Tuesday, January 6th, to Republicans on Capitol Hill, I believe. Let's listen.
You know, people are saying it goes down with one of the most incredible. It was so complex. 152 airplanes, many, many. Talk about boots on the ground. We had a lot of boots on the ground. But it was amazing. And think of it, nobody was killed. And on the other side, a lot of people were killed. Unfortunately, I say that, soldiers. Cubans, mostly Cubans, but many, many killed. They've been after this guy for years and years and years. And, you know, he's a violent guy. He gets up there and he tries to imitate my dance a little bit. But he's a violent guy. And he's killed millions of people. He's tortured. And now what they do, the radical left, they actually have people, and it's hard to get them. They're all paid people. Venezuela, everyone, they're marching in the streets. They love it, except in New York. I mean, where they find these people? They're the worst looking people I've ever seen.
That was Trump speaking to the House Republican retreats at the Kennedy Center, which is now known as the Trump Kennedy Center, although we're not going to call it that.
No.
It's good to see he's treating regime change as like the sobriety and seriousness with which it deserves, huh?
Yeah, yeah. There's just a lot there, you know.
Hot protesters.
Yeah. The good-looking protesters are... Maduro, by the way, bad guy, but I don't know where the millions of people come from. It's a little hyperbole. But yes, he seems like someone who's really feeling the weight of life and death decisions that he's making.
Definitely, definitely, as always. Okay, so speaking of life or death. So on Sunday, the Venezuelan government said that 80 people were killed in this Delta Force assault on Caracas and the associated airstrikes. Additionally, Ben, the Cuban government came out pretty quickly and said that 32 of its citizens were killed in the attack, including basically like all intelligence and military personnel. Did it surprise you that they released that number?
It didn't surprise me that there was that number. The Cubans have had intelligence personnel, but some of the kind of security around Maduro, some of the, you know, there's this deep ideological alliance between Cuba and Venezuela. So it didn't surprise me that that number were killed. I guess them putting it out, maybe they felt like it was going to get out. Like Trump was going to put it out.
Get ahead of it.
So I think they were probably just trying to get ahead of it.
Yeah. Strange. The Financial Times reported also that the colectivos, which are the regime's paramilitary groups, they've been arresting journalists and they've been cracking down on basically any civilians who take to the streets who are celebrating Maduro's removal. So the human rights situation for those keeping score at home in Venezuela is getting worse, not better, for actual human beings. Ben, I've also been just stunned at how much highly classified information the Trump administration has leaked to the media so quickly. So that started with the administration telling like literally every reporter that the CIA had an asset close to Maduro in Caracas who helped them find him. But then there's also been reports about the U.S. flying stealth drones over Venezuela. Presumably those were CIA drones, which means they are very, very sensitive secret, you know, items or, you know, programs. And then Trump has been bragging about how the U.S. military was able to disable the power grid in Caracas in advance of the strikes, which obviously, like, look, you can't keep it a secret when you take down a power grid. But he was sort of hinting at like the way we did it, which was likely done with some highly classified, like, you know, sort of cyber capabilities that the military has. So this is a little bit petty, but, you know, I remember when Republicans like Lindsey Graham, for example, would destroy us, you and me, you know, personally at times, when anything classified would leak, including about like the bin Laden operation. But they have absolutely nothing to say when Trump is just disclosing that the CIA had an asset on the ground in Venezuela, who might still be there. We have no idea.
Yeah, wouldn't necessarily want to be that asset.
No.
You know, look, the couple things about this are first of all, it's clear they were planning this for months. Look, we don't do this that much, but I mean, we've been saying that there are probably Delta Force guys there. We've been saying this regime change operation, but to have the combination of an offensive cyber operation, overhead drone capacity, Delta Force guys on the ground, pre-positioned naval assets. Like, they've been planning to do this for months. Like, that's my takeaway from the details that have come out.
And it cost billions of dollars.
Yes.
With a B.
With a B. And this puts the lie to the idea that, well, you know, we're going to do the boats. And no, this was always about this, right? And it took them months to get everything in place, to get the intelligence work done, to get people into the country, and then to do this. And then, yeah, like the kind of half-assed, haphazard way that they like to do these victory laps, they're just so thirsty to look like tough guys. What risk did Donald Trump take? I mean, I remember this when the bin Laden operation took place. Actually, you know, like, we were pretty careful about what we put out. We didn't even put out that it was Navy SEALs. like that kind of came out because I think some of the people in the military were like, hey, like we did this, which is great, you know, but you want to protect those capabilities in the future. We've just telegraphed, by the way, to and hope we don't have to do stuff like this again. And we'll talk about the fact that Trump probably wants to do this again. Here's like how we do it. You know, like here's the game plan. Like here's how we might go about regime change in your country, you know? So yeah, like the, all those people that spent years, you know, like beating the shit out of people like us because stuff would occasionally leak out or now just screaming it from the rooftops.
We're just celebrating it. There's also been some really interesting TikTok stories that have traced the evolution of Trump's policy. The Wall Street Journal reported that as recently as July, Trump wanted to cut a deal with Maduro, but he got fed up with him over the course of the year and felt like the negotiations weren't going anywhere. Several outlets have reported that the last straw for Trump was all those videos of Maduro dancing at public events because Trump felt like he was being mocked. I mean, you heard him mention it there in that clip. I think Trump seemed to think that Maduro was doing his dance as opposed to both of them just being like old dorks who can't dance.
They dance similarly. You know, it's a strong man problem. You know?
Yeah, it's a strong man problem. It's an old man problem. The best and final offer that Trump made to Maduro came on December 23rd. It was basically like, look, buddy, go live in exile. I'll get rid of sanctions on you and just shut up forever. But that was rejected. So Trump reportedly moved on to the military options, which clearly, as you said, had been planned for a long time. There's also been a bunch of reports on why Trump ended up installing Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, as president instead of Maria Machado, the head of the opposition. The Washington Post said it was because Trump was butthurt that Machado accepted the Nobel Peace Prize. A source close to the White House told the Post, quote, if she had turned it down, she'd be the president of Venezuela today, end quote. As we all know, Trump won the far more coveted FIFA Peace Prize, but he also wanted the less prestigious Nobel. Ben, that sourcing is a little thin for me, close to the White House, but it's also quite believable and a kind of fun thing, so I wanted to include it. But I don't know. I find it hard to believe that that was the sole reason he didn't go with Machado. We can get to the other reasons in a sec.
Well, you know, here's what I think, you know, you can tell from all of that information is, first of all, what is this really about? Because, you know, the biggest case against Maduro is not drug trafficking, right? If you were to assess the worst drug traffickers in the Western Hemisphere, Nicolas Maduro would not make the NCAA tournament bracket, you know? and in fact, we just, you know, pardoned one from the former president of Honduras, who is a huge drug trafficker. The case against Maduro is human rights violations. It's that he stole a democratic election. He arrests political opponents. There's allegations, credible allegations of torture against political opponents, suppression of journalists. But this operation clearly had nothing to do about that.
Yep.
If it had something to do about that, the entire focus of the United States government the day after the operation would be about how can we get Maria Machado or somebody from the opposition or the person who won the last election into power.
And Mundo Gonzalez, who is sort of like a carve-out for Machado, who is basically a figurehead who was allowed to run.
Machado's proxy. Or how can we have an election as soon as possible?
Right.
We're not even pretending that that's what this was about. So again, for anybody who's like, well, you know, this is good, you know, no, the same regime is in power. And as you said, the human rights situation has actually gotten worse because they're cracking down on people right now because they're clinging to power. So it's not about any of those things. It's about the optic of removing Maduro, just showing, hey, look, I can go get this guy with this kind of complex night raid because I don't care about laws. I don't care about norms. I don't care about all the second effects that this could cause. And it's about oil. And, you know, these people will be more likely because I just showed that if you don't do what I want, I can just, you know, put you in a helicopter and take you to New York. The next person up, Delcy Rodriguez, more likely to be like, sure, you know, Chevron, whatever American oil company, you can kind of do what you want here, take a bigger cut of the profits. That's all this is about, right? And and that to me, you know, yes, the personal stuff, it probably does factor in. It's probably not the chief factor, but it's probably like, oh, I don't like how he dances. I didn't get the Nobel Prize. I mean,
he is that petty. It's believable. The fact that it's believable is like, tells you a lot. I mean, by the way, I mean, the Venezuelan constitution calls for new elections within 30 days of a presidential vacancy. I haven't heard anyone in the Trump administration even mention that because they obviously don't give a shit, but it's just, you know, it's worth noting.
Yeah, I mean, it is literally like, you know, if you removed like Mullah Omar from the Taliban, but left the entire Taliban in charge of Afghanistan after 9/11. I mean, the apples to oranges, I'm not suggesting that this is the Taliban, but it's the same thing. Like the same regime is governing. It was a decapitation more than it was a total regime change.
Yeah.
With this idea that the United States is now going to be able to call the shots and run the country. And
yeah, exactly.
And I just don't, by the way, I don't believe that that's going to happen either. So we'll can get to that. But I don't think their plan is going to work.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I mean, so the Wall Street Journal had a more sort of substantive take. I mean, they reported that the White House asked the CIA to do an assessment of who was best positioned to lead a post-Maduro Venezuela. And the CIA determined that the top members of the Maduro regime were better positioned than the opposition leaders, which, you know, I don't think you needed a fucking multi-billion dollar budget or intel agency to tell you that. It's glaringly obvious, but I mean, it does make sense that they would task that. The New York Times reported that Machado pissed off Rick Grenell, who was the sentient Twitter troll, who early on made a big play to be Secretary of State. Then for a while was like Trump's primary envoy to Maduro and to Venezuela, but now seemingly has been relegated to like trying to book KISS at the Kennedy Center or whatever the hell he does. But the Times reported that Grenell was annoyed Machado refused to meet with him when he was in Caracas, and then refused to provide him with a list of political prisoners that they wanted to see released, which is sort of weird. They wouldn't do that. And Grenell was reportedly annoyed that Machado didn't have like a concrete plan for what to do if she were to take power, which again, is sort of like understandable on both ends. Like, I don't know that she had a lot of good options. And then to curry favor with Trump, you know, they talked about how Machado took a bunch of maximalist positions. Like, she opposed any talks with the Maduro government. She supported completely all the sanctions. She opposed any foreign investment in Venezuela. And that's the kind of hardline position you see from people outside, or Venezuelans outside of Venezuela. But it just sort of makes life hell for the people in the country. And so it wasn't necessarily popular. So Ben, anything else kind of jump out at you as like new or notable and interesting since, Saturday?
I think that assessment is the right one about from the CIA. Essentially, the problem is the military that buttresses this regime, is not going to want to, work with Maria Machado. Essentially, they control things. She's their enemy. Like she wants to dismantle the security apparatus of the regime. And so therefore there's kind of an all or nothing question. If you get rid of the regime entirely, if you say Machado has to be president, well, then those people are going to fight. And then you're going to be in some kind of civil conflict very quickly. And so, yes, it would have been difficult, if not impossible, absent more U.S. military force going in, to put Maria Machado or Edmundo Gonzalez, her proxy who won the last election, according to international monitors, in charge right away. That makes sense to me. However, I think what's interesting is there's no discussion of even a third option, because what you would normally do is you'd say, okay, this is a problem. We have a regime that doesn't have a lot of legitimacy to the people. It's a brutal regime. But we know that if we just try to install a new leader, they're going to fight that outcome, and then that could get us, you know, deeper into a quagmire in Venezuela. Well, what you would normally then do is try to set some roadmap to an election so that you have an event that at least creates the basis to have a new leader, or you'd have some negotiated transition. And yes, Machado has been very stubborn about, and I understand why, it's a principled position to say, I'm not talking to these guys. They throw my friends in prison. But look, the United States has all the leverage right now. And if you said, we all need to get together and have some kind of pacted transition, some kind of negotiation where there's essentially a power sharing between aspects of the existing regime, bring in the opposition, and then some roadmap to an election, that's what you do. But my take of what I've seen in the last couple of days is they have no competence, no patience, and no interest in doing that. They just don't give a shit about the Venezuelan people. Like, nothing that they say. They could have done more victory laps about the human rights possibilities of this. They just don't care. Like, Trump clearly could care less.
Just to add to your point, Ben, like, there's reportedly like something 800 some odd political prisoners in Venezuela. If Marco Rubio is running the country, why haven't they been released yet?
Yes. Yeah, they're not even saying like release a few symbolic ones, a few prominent journalists, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's that kind of just total lack of regard for this country that they just removed the leader from that is so striking to me. All they care about is getting oil contracts and doing victory laps on a special forces operation.
Yeah. And just on the Machado point, I mean, I wanted to play this clip mostly just because it kind of made me sad. Here is Maria Machado on Fox News, I think Monday night or maybe it was Sunday night, talking to Sean Hannity. Let's watch.
as soon as I learned that we had been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, I dedicated it to President Trump because I believed at that point that he deserved it.
Did you at any point offer to give him the Nobel Peace Prize? Did that actually happen? I had read that somewhere. I wasn't sure if it was true.
Well, it hasn't happened yet, but I certainly would love to be able to personally tell him that we believe the Venezuelan people, because this is a prize of the Venezuelan people, certainly want to give it to him and share it with him. What he has done, as I said, is historic.
This poor woman risked her life to run against Maduro, risked being tortured, risked her life again to escape Venezuela via this like dangerous sea journey out into the middle of the ocean when, you know, they almost didn't pick her up because like, the people she was supposed to rendezvous like hundreds of miles off the coast of Venezuela couldn't find her for a while, to then get to Europe to the Nobel Prize ceremony, which she actually missed, and is goes on Fox News and gets pressed about why she didn't give her Peace Prize to this asshole who just blew up the capital of her country. Like, just fucking bizarro land.
Yeah, I mean, there's a comedy and a tragedy to this, yeah. Right? And the comedy is that this is what we're talking about, like that Sean Hannity is talking about the Nobel Peace Prize. And look, Maria Machado is a right-wing person, right? I mean, and I admire her courage, but deep ties to the Republican Party. The lesson is just because you suck up to Trump and dedicate your award to Trump, it's never enough, right? Like kissing his ass is never enough. It will always. It's not enough that she dedicated it to him. She has to give it to him physically. He needs the medal, you know? Like, that's absurd. I think the darker piece of this is the reaction, Tommy, and I'm curious your thoughts on this. I felt very, not just because I was sick, I felt very weird the last couple of days because my brain is telling me we have a dictatorial leader who has now begun to invade countries and remove their leaders, and he threatened to, you know, invade several other countries since this went down. Okay, like, we've seen that movie in history. It's like a really scary movie. And yet, the reaction is this combination of on the right, Fox News, Donald Trump, he's the greatest man, you should give him the Nobel Prize. And even the mainstream media is more like, let's do the TikTok of the military operation. Yeah. And is this good for Trump? Or what are Democrats going to say? And it's like, I don't know, the period of history that it feels like we're living through now, is this what it was like in other countries? And I'm not going to draw the analogies. I'll let people listening use their own. But like, maybe this is what it's like. Like, you know, you conquer country after country and the state media is like Fox and everybody else is a little too scared to say that this isn't normal, you know? I'm getting a little existential here, but I mean...
No. I want to dig into the deeper kind of Don Rowe doctrine implications in a little bit as we get past the Venezuela stuff. I you had a great piece on this in the New York Times today.
Yeah, I tried to unpack it.
Got me thinking about it too. I mean, I you and I talked about this a bit on Saturday and I still feel the same way. I mean, mostly, look, I think the U.S. media and political reaction to like the opening days of wars is always like pretty fawning and kind of gross. I mean, there's some interesting pushback on Trump. Like Megyn Kelly was like, I'm reserving judgment about what's going on in Venezuela. And she actually called out Fox News for being state TV and said back in the day when she was at Fox News, she felt obligated to cheerlead every single war and felt burned by that in the long term, which, you know, like good for her for saying that. But that kind of voice was rare. But then you have like Rudy Giuliani tweeting like, cut off the entire head of the snake and like get rid of Rodriguez too. So there is a lot of triumphalism in these early days of war. There's very little consideration of the costs. The people pointing out that Iraq and Libya and all these other interventions ultimately were disasters were often shouted down and told that like, how dare you compare these places because they're different. It's like, well, of course they are. But, you know, what isn't different is that the United States isn't very good at solving political problems with the military. Whether or not it means, you know, Trump is like in the beginning of an authoritarian right wing, like fascist military bender. I don't know. But it certainly, it worries me. Definitely worries me.
Yeah. Well, and I to take it to Venezuela, there's no more clarity on what's actually going to happen there right now. I mean, like, you know, Delcy Rodriguez is in charge. What happens tomorrow and the next day? Like, is the opposition going to be brought in at all? How are the oil companies going to get in there? Like, who's going to rebuild the oil infrastructure? Who's going to pay for that? Like, what happens if somebody in Venezuela starts to have a try to have a coup because they feel like now's the time? Like, there's so many questions.
Yeah.
And what I'm struck by is that the lack of answers.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. The new year doesn't require a new you, maybe just a less burdened you. Therapy can help more easily identify what weighs you down or holds you back by offering an unbiased perspective to better understand your relationships, motivations, and emotions. BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial matching work so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences in their 12 or more years of experience. An industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recs. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is one of the world's largest online therapy platforms, having served over 5 million people globally, and it works with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Look at the stressful time of year, the holidays, there's work, there's family obligations, there's a lot going on in the world. You need therapy, give it a try, check out BetterHelp. They've helped millions of people and you could be the next one. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/crookedworld. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/crookedworld. Pod Save the World is brought to you by American Giant. We're all trying to get new stuff, look fashionable, keep up with the times, but you know what? A lot of it is crap that falls apart the second you wash it. Not American Giant. And this time of year, a good hoodie is essential, but it can be tough to find one that will last through the season. The American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime, so you can count on it to bring you comfort and warmth year after year. Slate Magazine called it the greatest hoodie ever made, and from cotton to zipper, it's made right here in the United States of America. I've got some great American Giant stuff myself. I got a sweatshirt. I got some really comfortable sweatpants. They are high quality and thick and durable. And mm-hmm. They've washed it a million times now because my kids get them disgusting. And it holds up. And it's just like the day I bought it and took it out of the bag. The iconic classic full zip hoodie is the jacket that started it all for American Giant. Custom heavyweight fleece and side panels for mobility make it the best hoodie ever. Body skimming fit with a double lined hood and reinforced elbow patches mean this hoodie will last. Born from a commitment to support the communities that create its products, every American Giant piece is made in America and designed to last. No exceptions. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. This season, snag the hoodie that'll bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip, and save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com. When you use promo code WORLD at checkout, that's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code WORLD.
Well, let's talk about the new president of Venezuela, Delcy Rodriguez, and then sort of the other power players who were left post-Maduro and sort of, what that tells us. So, Delcy Rodriguez and her brother, Jorge Rodriguez, they're like longtime political insiders. They've been advisors to Maduro. They've been advisors to Hugo Chavez. Jorge Rodriguez is like his, positions in the assembly and overseeing elections. Their dad was a left-wing guerrilla who was allegedly involved in the kidnapping of an American businessman in the 1970s. For that action, he was picked up by the then Venezuelan government and tortured to death. And so Delcy has said that she views like Chavismo and the movement that she is a part of as retribution for what happened to her dad, the murder of her dad by security forces. She is viewed as a very highly competent administrator. She built ties with the Venezuela's business community and basically transitioned the economy of the country, like such as it is, from socialism to capitalism. She helped oversee an increase in oil production. She's foreign educated. She worked as a foreign minister. She speaks English and French. One expert I was talking to said, she's corrupt as hell, but she's not a drug runner. She's like not corrupt in way, which probably makes her more palatable to the Trump people. Her brother is also like a very well-known quantity with the U.S. government. He's part of lots of talks in the U.S. However, like they're a big problem for Rodriguez is what she does not control, which what you were alluding to. Like she's not in charge of the military. That is the defense minister, Pedrino Lopez. She is not in charge of the intelligence agencies that's predominantly handled by Diosdado Cabello. Those who are also, they have the most control over these colectivo paramilitary groups that we mentioned earlier. So Ben, the questions you just raised are all the ones I have. Like, is she really in charge? I don't know. Can she stay in charge? Because ultimately, like the guys with the guns tend to end up in charge in these situations. And there's just all these ways that these like strong men around her can, pull cords like subtly to make her tenure as president end.
Yeah, or to make sure that, you know, their cut and their position is preserved. I mean, essentially you have, you know, in these circumstances, it's always the guys with the guns, as you say, who are going to preserve their position. She's kind of a negotiator. I see her as someone who's, you know, it's been interesting to watch her. She gave a kind of very left-wing pro-Maduro speech to the Venezuelan people, shoring up her bona fides as a Chavista. And then she put out a kind of conciliatory statement about, well, we'll dialogue with the United States. I see her as a negotiator. She's negotiating between Venezuelan business interests and the Venezuelan military and the more hardcore Chavistas. She's negotiating with the U.S. government. Like, that's what she's doing right now. She's not necessarily controlling all the levers of power, but she's navigating between them. There's always a moment after a shocking military operation like this where everybody's kind of waiting to see where things are going to go. Now, Trump and Stephen Miller, like his tough-talking, you know, viceroy for Venezuela, I guess, are saying like, well, they're going to have to listen to us because we've got these people, you know, in the Caribbean. Well, you know what? We had like 150,000 troops in Iraq.
Yep,
and
exactly.
People just stopped listening to us at a certain point because they realize at the end of the day, you're not really going to be here. Like, it's Venezuelans who are going to be in Venezuela. And there is the opposition, what are they going to do? They're going to fight? Are they just going to try to have an election? Are they going to try to get the political prisoners released? Is the military going to listen to things that she says? Like, all these questions about how that place is going to work are not answered by just saying, Delcy's in charge, but the U.S. is really running the place.
Right. Yep, that's right. And, you know, Politico reported, Ben, that the U.S. has like three big asks for Delcy Rodriguez. One, crack down on drug flows. Two, kick Iran and Cuban operatives out of Venezuela. I did notice that, like, I think the Iranian and Cuban ambassadors were some of the first people to greet her at her swearing-in ceremony. So I'm sure those images didn't go over that well in the White House. And then three, stop selling oil to U.S. adversaries like China. The only one of those that seems actually doable to me, Ben, is number two, which is kick out the Iranians and kick out the Cubans. Because if she really goes after the drugs, the corrupt generals who are part of the drug trade, who are actually, you know, referred to as Cartel de las Soles, could go after her. Do you think they can afford a rupture with the Chinese if suddenly, you know, Venezuela cancels all these Chinese oil contracts that they've had for years and years? So I don't know, maybe she will be able to pull off enough of this, but you could also see like Cabello and Lopez like setting her up to fail by allowing like just enough political instability that it's a headache for Trump, or it keeps the oil companies out of Venezuela.
Well, look, all of those are difficult, right? Because the like you said, maybe she can turn off some symbolic drug trafficking, but she can't kind of, these are criminals, right? Like they don't listen to authority by definition. The Cubans would be hard to get out of there because you talk about like the intelligence ministry. They're deeply embedded burrowed with the Cubans. It's kind of like a blurred together by design. The Iranians may be a little easier. The same, and the Chinese have been buying that oil for years. So this is all difficult stuff. And if you're in Venezuela, if you're one of these factions there, what you're probably thinking is Trump going to lose interest in this place? Like, he just did his big show, but everything you know about Trump is, you know, a few weeks go by and he's focused on something else. And so they have every incentive to kind of maybe throw some symbolic chum at Trump. Oh, we arrested this one drug dealer. Persona non grata,
yeah,
this one Iranian, or we let go of some political prisoners. But you basically would keep the regime in place, play for time. And then, you know, let's see how it goes.
Yeah, they know when our midterms are. They know that a reinvasion gets harder and harder. By the way, I drew out a lot of this section from this great reporting in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. There's papers by the Crisis Group that were really great. And then our friend Juan Gonzalez had a great piece in Foreign Affairs magazine that's worth reading. And Juan also pointed out to me when we were talking that, like, you have a lot of very experienced fighters hanging out kind of in and around Venezuela, like, you know, the remnants of the FARC, the group called ELN.
ELN, yeah.
They are skilled fighters, they are skilled in urban combat.
Yeah.
They could stage operations that do just enough to scare away these oil companies, and there is no surge in energy.
If Trump may have to put U.S. boots on the ground to protect the oil companies if they're really going to get in there. And I'm just wondering how the American people are going to feel about deploying a bunch of troops to secure like Chevron interests in Venezuela that will be funded by American taxpayers paying to rebuild Venezuelan oil fields like th- it's a crazy, what is the benefit of this operation?
Yeah.
Because I don't
think politics get worse.
Nicolas Maduro is not like some key piece of the international drug trade.
No.
Right. So it's not like you really did anything in the international drug trade. What is actually, there's a lot of risk of greater violence, civil war, state collapse, all these things we talk about. The benefit that Trump articulates is purely oil, but that's going to take years to rebuild that oil infrastructure, billions of dollars that the American people will have to spend, and probably the deployment of U.S. troops to secure that oil infrastructure. So I'm not sure what the win is in this.
Yeah. One other important thing we've learned in the last couple of days from the new indictment of Maduro is that the Justice Department is no longer alleging that he is the leader of an actual cartel called Cartel de los Soles. That claim was first made in their indictment of Maduro back in 2020. And then that language from that indictment was used to designate Cartel de los Soles as a terrorist organization by both the Treasury Department and the State Department. And then you repeatedly heard guys like Marco Rubio say, well, Maduro is a designated leader of a narco-terrorist group. So, of course, we have to, like, take him out. But, you know, actual Venezuela experts kept pointing out that Cartel de los Soles is not a real organization. It is a slang term invented by the Venezuelan media to refer to corrupt officials who are corrupted by drug money in particular. And so this new Maduro indictment reflects that reality, Ben, and says Cartel de los Soles refers to a patronage system or a culture of corruption that is fueled by drug money. In other words, the Trump administration, they knew the 2020 claim was bullshit, so they had to pull it because they knew they couldn't, you know, get it passed in a court of law. And so they dropped the thing. So, you know, that seemed to be, you know, good. Again, shout out Charlie Savage at the New York Times for kind of reporting this out and flagging it. But like, it seems like a pretty astounding admission, since designating this fake cartel as a terrorist group is the linchpin of this made up legal strategy that the Trump administration has pointed to justify these airstrikes where they've been murdering people in the Caribbean and in the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, but it just shows the disregard that they have for it, because essentially they know that when they get in a court of law and they actually have to prosecute Maduro, they can't make shit up because then the case will get thrown out. But they can make shit up to send an armada to the Caribbean. You know, think about that. Like, they're not worried about lying to the whole world to justify invading this country, lying to the American people, lying to Congress. But they do know they can't lie to a judge because he might toss the case. You know, it tells you a lot about how they operate.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Last thing, there have been a lot of comparisons to this, the Maduro operation, to the operation against Manuel Noriega in the 1980s and early 1990s, that we thought we'd just spend a minute just talking about that. So for those who don't know, maybe weren't alive then, the operation against Noriega started in December of 89 and ended in January of 1990. Then President George H.W. Bush, he ordered this operation, to an invasion of Panama, to arrest Manuel Noriega, who was the dictator running Panama at the time. The scale of that operation was massive. Like, the U.S. deployed 26,000 troops. I think about half of them were already in Panama, because at the time, U.S. Southern Command was located in Panama. Now it's in Florida. But this invasion came after, you know, lots of repression of the Panamanian people by Noriega, lots of evidence that he was involved in drug trafficking, the killing of a U.S. Marine by a Panamanian soldier. And then the Panamanian General Assembly passed a resolution declaring that there was a state of war, that a state of war existed between the U.S. and Panama, which I think was twisted to suggest that Panama had declared war on the U.S., which wasn't really what happened, wasn't really intended, but whatever, you know, it's history now. So the U.S. invades, Noriega hides in the Vatican diplomatic mission for a few days before he gives himself up. 23 U.S. troops were killed, hundreds were wounded, hundreds of Panamanian troops were killed along with hundreds of civilians, and the U.S. military just leveled Panama City. Like, tens of thousands of people lost their homes and became, you know, IDPs or refugees. But I think what makes that operation especially crazy, Ben, in the benefit of hindsight, is that, like, Noriega was a longtime CIA asset. Throughout the Cold War, the CIA paid Noriega for information about the Cubans or about, you know, or to train the Contras or other, you know, do other dirty deals for them. And they turned a blind eye to the fact that he was a military dictator who killed his political opponents. He was a serial rapist. He was a massive drug trafficker and just, by all means, like, an evil dude. But, like, you know, he's our friend. And then the Cold War ends. The war on drugs starts. George H.W. Bush goes from CIA director to president, and he turns on his old ally or asset. And here we are. Before you know it, Noriega's, you know, getting prosecuted in a court in the U.S. So, you know, an interesting but very dark bit of history, Ben. And it's like, I think if you really dig into the details of the Noriega operation, it's not necessarily a comparison I would want to make if I were the Trump administration.
Yeah, you covered the bad part of the operation. I guess the other piece I'd say is that sometimes it gets cited because, you know, the aftermath went pretty well. Like, they kind of, you know, had an election, new government there. But Panama is much smaller than Venezuela, you know, and that's where it doesn't hold. Like, Venezuela is a country of 30 million people, massive geography. Replicating a political transition in a bigger, much more complex country with like an ideologically entrenched regime is a much, much larger task. And Trump, one night raid is not going to transform Venezuela, you know? Like, that's what's so maddening about this. In the same way that in Panama, like, you know, we had more of a capacity to do that because it was just, we're playing on a smaller field.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. But for our international listeners in Australia, I just want to let you know that Pod Save America is coming to Australia and New Zealand. We're going to be there in Auckland on February 11th and do three cities in Australia after that. Melbourne on February 13th, Brisbane on the 14th, and Sydney on the 16th. If you live in Australia, if you live in New Zealand, come see Pod Save America. It'll be fun. Tickets are on sale now. Go to crooked.com/events.
Pod Save the World is brought to you by Sundays for Dogs. New year, new you should always include eating better, right? Well, if you're upgrading and optimizing what goes in your body, then why are our dogs still stuck with the same old kibble routine? Give them real food, give them good food, give them Sundays for Dogs. Sundays was founded by a veterinarian and mom, Dr. Tori Waxman, who got tired of seeing so-called premium dog food full of fillers and synthetics. So she designed Sundays, air-dried, real food made in a human-grade kitchen using the same ingredients and care you'd use to cook for yourself and for your family. Every bite of Sundays is clean and made from real meat, fruits, and veggies, and no kibble. That means no weird ingredients you can't pronounce and no fillers. Compared to kibble and other brands out there, Sundays invest 50 times more in its ingredients to ensure premium quality. Because your dog deserves food made with care, not in the interest of cost-cutting. And the best part, you can scoop and serve. No freezer, no thawing, no prep. No mess, just nutrient-rich, clean food that fuels their happiest, healthiest days so you can get more of them to share together. Listen, we love our dogs like family members.
You bet.
Often more. Why not feed them the same kind of quality food that you would feed a cousin, a brother, a child? And, you know, watch how happy it makes your dog. Watch how thrilled they are, how much more energy they have, the better mood, the more calm and focused, softer coat, less itching, no eye boogers, better poops, all of the above. Check out Sundays for Dogs. Make the switch to Sundays. Go right now to sundaysfordogs.com/world30 and get 30% off your first three orders. Or you can use the code world30 at checkout. That's 30% off your first three orders at sundaysfordogs.com/world30, sundaysfordogs.com/world30, or use code world30 at checkout.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, so let's do a big picture and talk about the Donroe Doctrine. I think that's the thing that, like, you and me and everyone else in the world basically is trying to figure out is what this Venezuela operation tells us about how Trump is going to conduct foreign policy going forward. You know, we've talked about the Donroe Doctrine, which is Trump's belief that he's the emperor of the Western Hemisphere. We covered a lot of this when they released their national security strategy last year because it was spelled out in pretty plain English. But Trump and his team have made a bunch of alarming and illustrative comments ever since. So we're going to play a couple of those for you. So the first is a supercut of Trump talking with reporters on Air Force One on Sunday, where he threatens to invade a bunch of countries. So let's roll that one first.
Colombia is very sick too, run by a sick man who likes making cocaine and selling it to the United States. And he's not going to be doing it very long. Cuba is ready to fall, you know?
Yes.
By the way, you have to do something with Mexico. Mexico has to get their act together. Greenland is covered with Russian and Chinese ships all over the place. We need Greenland, the Donro Doctrine.
Okay, and here is newly minted Viceroy of Venezuela, Stephen Miller, talking with CNN's Jake Tapper on CNN.
The United States is using its military to secure our interests unapologetically in our hemisphere. We're a superpower, and under President Trump, we are going to conduct ourselves as a superpower. It is absurd that we would allow a nation in our own backyard to become the supplier of resources to our adversaries, but not to us, to hoard weapons from our adversaries, to be able to be positioned as an asset against the United States, rather than on behalf of the United States.
Sovereign countries shouldn't be able to do what they want to do.
The Monroe Doctrine and the Trump Doctrine is all about securing the national interests of America. This whole period that happened after World War II, where the West began apologizing and groveling and begging
I don't even know honestly what you're talking about right now.
You're approaching this from the wrong frame. This neoliberal frame that the United States' job is to go around the world and demanding immediate elections be held everywhere, immediately, all the time, right away, to create these vacuums.
That's not what I think, but you invaded the country. We went into the country and we seized the leader of Venezuela.
Damn straight we did.
And I'm saying, so is the U.S. going to have new elections?
The point is that we're not going to let tin pot communist dictators send rapists into our country, send drugs into our country, send weapons into our country.
Okay.
Barry Weiss wants to make sure you interview that guy for 60 minutes. Yeah, yeah. I do love how he's ranting about how we're not going to let Venezuela only sell oil to the fucking, you know, Chinese or whatever. It's like, you guys sanctioned them in 2019 and banned us from being able to buy
their oil. Yeah.
Whatever. So, Ben, we've talked about like the big picture, right? Which is that Trump thinks he's the emperor of the Western Hemisphere. He thinks he gets to dictate events in Central and South America. But what kind of specific steps are you worried about or watching for him to take next? Like specifically keeps mentioning Cuba. Do you think there's going to be some sort of like overt or covert move on the Cuban government? Do you think he might really do something to Petro in Colombia? Like how are you watching to see how this plays out?
Yeah, no, I'll keep it. I mean, there's so much there, but
I know.
I do want to say just for the YouTube viewers, Lindsey Graham's face, each time Trump threatens to depose another government, it looks like he just took a bump of cocaine.
Yep.
And actually, when he says Cuba, he's like, ah, like he literally looks like a jolt went through him or something.
His first Viagra erection since 2003.
There's a lot there. Congratulations.
Not that much.
Congratulations, MAGA voters and, isolationist, all-in potters, who thought Trump was this guy that was going to end the imperial foreign policy. What Stephen Miller is describing is an empire in all the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. Which he keeps describing as our hemisphere. And when he says our, he doesn't just mean it like communally we all live here. It means these are possessions of ours, essentially, which is an insane thing to say. I mean, these are sovereign countries. It's a big fucking hemisphere. Sao Paulo is 5,000 miles from New York, but in terms of what I expect, which is always hard with Trump, he seems most focused on two kinds of places, right? One, are there natural resources there that I can extract and my buddies can get rich off of? And then I'll probably take some massive back end cut, So like whatever oil's being drilled in Venezuela 10 years from now, Trump's kids are like
the Trump library. Yeah, it's got a little spigot. Like,
And two, is it some kind of boogeyman, that I can gin up my right wing base about, right? So for that reason, here are the countries I'm most worried about on his list of places to bomb, right? On Cuba, I do think that they will try for the regime change. They've got, Marco Rubio, they've got parts of their political base in Miami. They would like to see the Cuban regime gone. They, you know, there's a lot of economic interest that could be developed in Cuba in the tourism industry that, like, Trump. I know for a fact, by the way, Tommy, because I did the Cuban negotiations, the Trump organization was down scouting like golf and hotel properties in Cuba in 2016. So Cuba's both an ideological thing for them, but it's also like a money grab. And I would not expect that to necessarily be a new Bay of Pigs invasion. They'll probably see if they can do it with some kind of, you know, covert sabotage type stuff, squeeze the regime. But who knows? Like, at the end of the day, they may just do another one of these kinds of things and see how it goes. I don't think it'll go well, but we can get to that later. Mexico. I do think all the chest thumping about drug trafficking and fentanyl, there is this kind of momentum towards strikes in Mexico, not for regime change, but to kind of show that we're going to take shots in Mexico. That deals with his political base on drugs. Greenland, I would be very, very surprised if they don't try to seize Greenland. I would, mm-hmm. I put it at above 50% because that's the resource rich place. Like, there's all this stuff up there, right? There's, you know, critical minerals, and there's oil and gas, and so those three: Greenland, Cuba, and potentially strikes in Mexico. Colombia seems crazy to me, especially because Colombia's going to have an election. And
Petro's term is up in August. He can't run again. Yeah. I think the first round is in like a couple months. So like, it would be crazy. Yeah. If I were Petro, I'd shut the fuck up for 6 months. But,
and you know, I don't know. He's like, I kind of like,
it's helping his politics. It's helping him politically. It's helping his party. Yeah.
And it's probably gonna help his party a little bit. But I think this is not the end. I do not think Venezuela is the end. And I think they mean what they say, that they want to run this place like an empire. They keep telling us this. And I don't know why we wouldn't listen to them.
We got to believe them. We got to listen. Yeah. So let's play another clip of Stephen Miller specifically talking about Greenland. And then let's dig in on that piece.
Greenland has a population of 30,000 people, Jake. The real question is, by what right does Denmark assert control over Greenland? What is the basis of their territorial claim? What is their basis of having Greenland as a colony of Denmark? The United States is the power of NATO. For the United States to secure the Arctic region, to protect and defend NATO and NATO interests, obviously Greenland should be part of the United States. And so that's a conversation that we're going to have as a country. That's a process we're going to have as a community of nations.
So you can't take it off the table that the U.S. would use military force to seize Greenland. You can't take it off the table.
Jake, I understand you're trying very hard to, which again, is your job. I respect it. It's great to get exactly the headline, right, that catchy headline.
I'm trying to get an answer.
That says Miller refuses to rule out. The United States should have Greenland as part of the United States. Nobody's going to fight the United States militarily over the future of Greenland.
It's not the key point, but his voice is so fucking annoying. So the world is taking this very, like, the world, I think, agrees with you, Ben. So the Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, said she is taking Trump's Greenland threat very seriously, and that him claiming Greenland would mean, quote, the international community as we know it, democratic rules of the game, NATO, the world's strongest defensive alliance, all of that would collapse if one NATO country chose to attack another. Those are the stakes. It's not just about like a block of ice who controls 30,000 people's fate, right? It's that in her mind. And then, you know, earlier today, there was a joint statement about Greenland from France, Germany, Italy, Poland, Spain, the UK, and Denmark. It says in part, security in the Arctic must therefore be achieved collectively in conjunction with NATO allies, including the United States, by upholding the principles of the UN Charter, including sovereignty, territorial integrity, and the inviolability of borders. These are universal principles, and we will not stop defending them. Greenland belongs to its people. It is for Denmark and Greenland and them only to decide on matters concerning Denmark and Greenland. So it is just clear from these statements that this would lead to a rupture of like the entire post-World War II order, full stop.
Yeah. If people are watching this and thinking like, well, you know, what's the big deal? Why can't the United States, you know, there are only, you know, 30,000 or 50,000 people there, or even Maduro, like, we did this, what's the big deal? There's two problems, meta problems, right? One is that the Trump administration just doesn't give a shit about people. So if the people getting blown up in the boats are fishermen, they don't care. If Venezuela descends into violent chaos, they don't care. Like, there's a valueless, if you're not an American, and probably specifically a white American. They don't give a shit about you. And that's an alarming worldview. And that tends to lead to bad things that happen, you know, where we break countries and they're a mess for years. The second piece is one you just said, though. Like, we are breaking every single rule that has held the world together since World War II. People got together after World War II because they had seen where autocrats, nationalism, and military aggression led. It led to two world wars. Those two world wars were so devastating that everybody got together and were like, we need laws of war to govern how and when countries can go to war. We need laws to make sure that sovereignty is an inviolable principle so big countries just don't invade small ones, because they didn't want not just another world war, they didn't want a nuclear world war. They didn't want World War III, right? That's why you get a whole UN system, all these things. And Trump is tearing at all of that with this. And look, Greenland is actually the best example of it, more than Venezuela. Why Denmark? Stephen Miller's like, why shouldn't that be ours instead of Denmark's? So look, I'm not a Greenlander. I can't speak to how the Danish have been there. They've probably done some, you know, shitty things over the years. But for 300 years, like, this has kind of been a part of Denmark. Like, and so, you know, if you go in and say, we're going to take this massive geography with all these natural resources and just claim it because we're stronger, you are going to shatter NATO. You are going to shatter the U.S. alliance with Europe. You are going to encourage the Russians and Chinese to grab more of their own, because then they're going to see, we're in a resource competition. We're in a great power competition. We need to grab more territory. Right. And so suddenly it's not just a Taiwan question. What else is China going to try to grab? What else is Russia going to grab? And ultimately, as happened in World War I and World War II, when you have expansionist empires, they bump into each other and they end up fighting a war with each other. And it may not start like the day after we take Greenland, but that is the course that he is setting us on by doing this. And by having this fucking, you know, two-bit like Jeff Sessions staffer cosplay fascist who thinks he's like a NATO geopolitics expert, you know, talking about like our right to Greenland, is we shouldn't be.
Well, getting, and a lot of this came from his wife's dumb trolling tweet of like Greenland with an American flag on it. Yeah. I mean, like the big question I have is like, does the Donroe Doctrine mean the Western Hemisphere is ours? Clearly, he doesn't care if Putin carves up Ukraine or Europe. He's like, whatever, go deal with it. I wonder what it means for Taiwan. I think he'll probably trade away Taiwan. But I think the big question then is like, what happens if the Chinese go after an island that is claimed by the Japanese, right? And suddenly, like, there's a hot conflict there. We should point out that on Monday, the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting about us, about the United States. The Secretary General of the UN said the U.S. violated the UN Charter. We were like criticized by Brazil and China and Cuba and Mexico. We even got denounced by the French, who said that the Maduro operation, quote, chips away at the very foundation of the international order. But just quickly back to Lindsey Graham, right? Like, this fucking guy has been, first of all, he's a neocon, he's in favor of every war. But like, one area where we agreed with him on policy generally was his support for Ukraine, because he viewed, you know, Ukraine as the first domino that would fall, and then the Russians would move across Europe and they would hit a NATO country and NATO would get drawn into the fight. Yet he's sitting there yucking it up as Trump is talking about taking Greenland, which all of our closest NATO allies say would unravel NATO as we know it. And he's like, oh, and he's like, thinks it's fun and it's a good fucking time, because I don't know, he's got a war boner again. And it's just like, I hate these people. I hate them. They have no principles. They have no values. They mean nothing.
No, and everything, like, this is a really important point. And like, because, you know, we have some listeners I know who've been following this kind of stuff for years. And it's like, these people, like Lindsey Graham, have showed up as defenders of democracy in the world for like decades, right? Like back to the John McCain days. But that was all bullshit. They sold out Maria Machado the day that Trump decided that he'd rather deal with the Maduro regime people. They sold out Europe the day that like the Republican Party became like a far right ethno-nationalist party that was a, like, they don't trust these people. Like, you know, like they're the wrong people, and their ideas are dangerous. And the reality is this Greenland thing, it's going to come to a head. Like, we're not 1 year into Trump. You think in the next 3 years, he's not going to try to make a play on Greenland? And how do you have a NATO when the whole basis of the alliance is collective defense and you've got one member just seizing the territory of another? Like, it doesn't work. And then to throw Lindsey Graham's arguments back at him, without NATO, Well, then you really do have the likelihood that Putin will go into the Baltics, that Putin will go into Europe proper.
Yep.
Because NATO's the thing that stops him from doing that.
Yep. It's really bad. Okay, we are going long today, but you know that's fine because there's a lot of important stuff at the top. But our last topic is Iran and these protests. So the protests began on December 28th. It was when some electronics vendors went on strike in Tehran. There soon, there was a bunch of other merchants and shopkeepers in the capital who joined in. Then the protests spread to universities. And this so often happens with these protest movements. As the number of people protesting grows, the reasons and the demands from the protesters grow as well. So initially, it was all about Iran's economy. The regime had raised increased gas prices. Inflation was been like 40% for a long time. The Iran's currency has collapsed. Tehran could literally run out of water soon. I mean, that's sort of a very scary scenario for them. But now you got protesters calling for the end of the regime, period. And there's reports, Ben, that about 35 people have been killed. About 1,200 have been arrested. Iranians are now protesting, or there's been reports or confirmed reports of a protest in about 200 locations in 26 of Iran's 31 provinces, according to this U.S.-based human rights activist news agency. So these are not just like, you know, urban liberals. It's like everywhere now. This is the biggest protest movement in Iran since 2022, which we covered at the time. It was a young woman named Mahsa Amini was murdered by Iran's so-called morality police. Back then, the security forces cracked down hard. They killed about 500 people. Now the regime seems a bit paralyzed as to what they should do or how to respond. On Saturday, the Supreme Leader called the original protesters' grievances legitimate, but he also said, quote, rioters must be put in their place, which is ominous. However, President Pezeshkian said he wants his interior minister to meet with protesters. He wants them to hear them out. And on Monday, the government announced that they would give most citizens a monthly payment equivalent to like $7. So I don't know how far that'll go, but it doesn't seem like much. Trump has commented on the situation several times. Last Thursday, he posted on social media that if Iran, quote, violently kills peaceful protesters, which is their custom, the United States of America will come to their rescue, end quote. He repeated that threat on Sunday in that same gaggle we played you a clip from earlier, which, you know, after the Maduro operation certainly gave it some added weight. Of course, our favorite boy, Lindsey Graham, weighed in on this as well. Here he is on Fox News, again, being a very serious person. I think this was Trey Gowdy over the weekend.
Unlike Obama, President Trump has not turned his back on the people of Iran. So I pray and hope that 2026 will be the year that we make Iran great again.
It's a very cool hat, Dork. Lindsey Graham just put on a Make Iran Great Again hat there. Although it was black and I don't know. I hate him. So, Ben, let's start with the protests themselves and then get to the U.S. response. So what are you watching for in terms of tipping points or something that might lead to, you know, a signal that there might be an actual regime change? And what do you make of this kind of seemingly incoherent response from the regime so far, or at least kind of all over the place?
I think what's clear is that the regime is very weak, weaker than they've been in a very, very long time for a lot of different reasons, right? Some of it is they took some shots from Israel, obviously. And I don't just mean the nuclear program. I mean, like their air defenses got taken out, some of their proxy network got depleted. But more of it is just it's an old, sclerotic, shitty regime.
You know? The Supreme Leader is 86.
That's the main problem they have is it's a corrupt, sclerotic, ideological regime that has not delivered for its own people for a very long time. And we've seen protests, you know, for decades in Iran. And each time it feels like they come back bigger, you know, and they don't have answers to the people, the things that people are protesting over. I also think it's important to note that the 2022 protests, the Women Life Freedom protests, succeeded in some respects.
Oh, yeah.
Women are starting to go uncovered in Tehran, which was in Iran, which is a sign that the regime couldn't reimpose its will, right? That's a sign of weakness too. And so I think you have a lot of internal cracks in that regime. The problem going forward is there's no clear path to like, well, what is would come next,
right?
Because the reality is it's like the Venezuela thing. Let's say the Supreme Leader got the protest built and built and built, and the Supreme Leader like, you know, fled the coup and went to Moscow like to hang out with Assad. The IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, are probably the people that would run the country. They're the people with the guns, you know. And Trump, you know, bombing them isn't going to change that. Lindsey Graham putting on a hat isn't going to change that either. And so I think, you know, I don't expect there to be some regime collapse followed by some new government, you know, return to the Shah or like an election next week. I just think we're in a period of instability. And the question is whether or not, you know, Israel tries to take advantage of that by bombing Iran again and seeing if that it's like a, you know, hitting a boxer who they think is about to go down. I don't think that would be good because actually I think the more chaotic the collapse is of this regime, the more likely there's a civil war and the IRGC are the people that are running the place.
Yeah. I mean, also, like, look, the, to your point, I mean, the Supreme Leader is 86. So regime change is coming sooner
it's coming.
Or later.
It's coming.
You know,
it's coming.
Actuarially.
And he's the longest serving dictator in the world.
Yeah. And like, so I think that does also seem to have made some of the other kind of politicians and competing power centers more willing to criticize him and criticize the regime. Pezeshkian's offer to meet with protesters like sounds like a concession, but imagine doing that in practice. Like imagine putting yourself forward being like, yes, I would like to tell you my name and have a conversation with you and go to a locked room with you. Like you could end up in prison. It seems like a bad idea. It is hard to overstate, I think, the degree to which like the value of the rial has dropped in the last year. I think it dropped 75%. It's like 1.4 million rial to the dollar. So like the economy in Iran is in crisis, and that is in large part because of U.S. sanctions. But let's talk about this U.S. response, Ben, because I do think that there's kind of a threshold question, which is, is Trump serious? Would Trump really intervene if there was a crackdown on protesters? And if so, what would he do? Trump didn't use the words red line like Obama did with Syria, but clearly he drew a red line by saying, if the regime kills protesters, the U.S. will, quote, come to their rescue. However, it does seem clear like the regime has already killed protesters. So Trump has not done anything yet. So the red line has been crossed. But maybe, I don't know, maybe we interpret it as like some widespread use of force by the Iranian military or something. But again, the question is, one, Ben, like, do you believe him? Two, do you think the Iranian protesters believe him? Because the U.S. has this long history of promising or at least suggesting to protesters that if they rise up, we will get their backs. And then we let them get massacred. For example, in 1991, George H.W. Bush encouraged Iraqis to take to the streets to take down Saddam Hussein. So a bunch of them did. And then Saddam massacred tens of thousands of Kurds and Shia. And the U.S. did nothing. So the words matter a lot. The stakes are very high here. And it's sort of a question of, you know, we know Trump is not like, you know, measured with his words. But in the wake of the Maduro operation, maybe they take on some added weight.
Yeah, if I were the protesters, I wouldn't be buying it. And you know, because Trump has been all over the map on Iran, right? One day he wants a deal, one day he's bombing them, you know. One day he's threatening to bomb them if they cracked down on protesters. But also, like, nobody believes that that's out of any sincere interest in protecting protesters. Like, is, you know, there's not other countries in the world where Trump cares about violent crackdowns. You know, he's not a human rights motivated person, you know. So the only way they might believe it is if it looks like the regime's about to fall. But again, what does it mean for that regime to fall? Like, what is in place after, like, whatever the thing that drives me the most crazy, Tommy, is when I see the kind of people that you have more patience to fight with online than me being like, you know, you don't care about the Iranian people. Or no, I don't, if you're just seeing them as a tool on your geopolitical chess game, to me, that's the definition of not caring about the Iranian people. Because if this place collapses into civil war, that could be fucking awful. You know,
yep.
I mean, part of what I think the protesters, so people want to ask me, well, what should happen? I think part of what these protesters are doing is they know change is coming. Like the Supreme Leader is going to die soon, or you may have to, like, you know, just leave power because he's old and he's losing control. And can there be some kind of pathway to just a different system in Iran that might not be exactly what, you know, the U.S. and Israel would impose on Iran, which is probably like the Shah again, you know,
but who's rather, making a lot of noise about coming back. Did a Wall Street Journal Q&A. Like,
well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't think that that's what the Iranian people want. You know, I'm just going to go out there on a limb. Can there just be some Iranian process to like negotiate like a pathway in a different direction? That will take time. But that's better than the regime collapsing and there being a civil war, or it's better than the Supreme Leader being ousted, but then the IRGC's in charge, right? And again, I don't know, like Trump bombing, I mean, this is when things start to, if we're bombing Iran within like weeks of removing the leader of Venezuela, after we bombed Nigeria on Christmas, it really does feel like the Donro Doctrine is taking us into like this kind of global roving U.S. military conflict, which people may say we've already been in that with the war on terror, but now we're getting at like territorial expansion. We're getting at like significant geopolitical players. It is a different level of anything we've done since we went into Iraq.
Yeah. For what it's worth. So, you know, in the interest of like wanting to learn from mistakes from the Obama administration, you know, we were in the White House in 2009 when the GRIEVE movement rose up. President Obama, you know, sort of did not full-throatedly support that movement at the time because there was concern that it could kind of steal their thunder as like a glib way to do it. But, you know, distract from what was a clear internal Iranian-led movement and suddenly make it about the U.S., which was sort of it's always Iran's propaganda, right? Which is, this is like a U.S. Zionist, you know, puppet movement. It's not real. It's AstroTurf. I asked Obama about this in 2022 when we interviewed him. Here's what he had to say.
You know, when I think back to 2009, 2010, you guys will recall there was a big debate inside the White House about whether I should publicly affirm what was going on with the Green Movement, because a lot of the activists were being accused of being tools of the West. Right. And there was some thought that we were somehow going to be undermining their street cred in Iran if I supported what they were doing. And in retrospect, I think that was a mistake. Every time we see a flash, a glimmer of hope, of people longing for freedom, I think we have to point it out. We have to shine a spotlight on it. We have to express some solidarity about it.
I thought that was really interesting, Ben, that he kind of wanted to make that point. He kind of like pivoted to pointing out that, you know, he felt like that was a mistake and he wished, you know, we had been more full-throated in 2009 in support of the Green Movement.
I think that was wrong. And look, I think you and I were arguing on the other side of that White House debate at the time. But look, I that was interesting. But I take a couple lessons from that, right? It was wrong not to speak out forcefully on behalf of those protesters at that time, to be a source of solidarity to those protesters. That said, I don't think Obama going out earlier and being forceful in his statements about the protests would have made the regime fall.
No.
And that's part of what drives me nuts about these debates online, is it's kind of like if Obama had issued a statement, the regime would have fallen. And actually, people might then to swing it all the way in the other direction. Obama told me privately, you know, when the Arab Spring happened, he didn't want to make the mistake again of not being supporting protests. So we spoke out about the protests. And guess what? I don't think it was because of our statements, but a lot of those regimes did fall. And like, it was a bit chaotic, right? I mean, so you have to learn these lessons, right? What people deserve who are protesting is solidarity. They need to know that the world supports them. They need to know that the world's attention is on this. They need to know that the regime can't sweep it under the rug. Sometimes you can do certain things like help provide internet access into a country. But ultimately, it's up to the people of the country itself to change the place. And that's what most protesters will tell you they want to do themselves. Israel bombing them is not necessarily going to help them deal with the situation, you know?
Right. Or the U.S. arming some, you know, opposition that some, you know, exile tells us we should be giving weapons to. I mean, look at Syria, right? Like all these efforts to foment regime change in Syria for 15 years failed until a former ISIS guy, a former Al-Qaeda guy decided to drive his truck to fucking Damascus and took the place over. And here we are.
Yeah, no, there's plenty of lessons from the last 25 years, and Trump is probably not trying to learn any of them.
That is, I think, a definite. Okay, so that's it for us for the news section. Thank you guys for listening. But stick around, because after the break, you're going to hear from Congressman Joaquin Castro about the congressional debate over Venezuela and what Congress could do to prevent Trump from, I don't know, invading Greenland or a whole bunch of other countries. So stick around for that.
This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform designed to elevate your online presence and drive your success. Squarespace provides all the necessary tools to claim your domain, build a professional website, expand your brand, and facilitate payments. making it the ideal solution for businesses of all sizes. Squarespace gives you everything you need to offer services and get paid, all in one place. From consultations to events and experiences, showcase your offerings with a customizable website designed to attract clients and grow your business. With Squarespace's collection of cutting-edge design tools, anyone can build a bespoke online presence that perfectly fits their brand or their business. Start with Blueprint AI, Squarespace's AI-enhanced website builder, to get a fully custom website in just a few steps, using basic information about your industry, your goals, and personality to generate premium-quality content and personalized design recommendations. With Squarespace email campaigns, all the tools you need to engage clients, promote your services, and grow your business are built in. Set up email automations to stay connected, nurture leads, and save time while seamlessly integrating your offerings into beautifully designed templates that drive bookings and sales. Schedule emails that reach your audience at the perfect time, keeping your business at top of mind and driving long-term growth. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/world to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/world.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
All right, well, I'm very pleased to be joined by Congressman Joaquin Castro, who represents the 20th District of Texas, down there in San Antonio, wonderful place. He's the ranking member of the Western Hemisphere Subcommittee on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. So he's the most senior House Democrat on these issues. He's also a member of the House Intelligence Committee. So he's looking at this from multiple directions. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, good to be with you.
I do just want to start, actually, by saying... After the tremendous New York Knicks victory in the NBA Cup, your San Antonio Spurs ripped my heart out on Christmas Day and sent the Knicks spiraling. Well, so we're even now.
You got us back. You guys got us back. As you remember, in 1999, that was the first Spurs victory. That was the first championship against the New York Knicks.
That's so right.
I
that's
can't
right.
Blame me for taking joy in defeating.
No, us. No. I remember that was the David Robinson, Tim Duncan championship.
That's right, yeah.
Well, anyway, those are better days. We're here to talk about grimmer news. But look, you've been one of the most outspoken Democrats about what Trump's been doing in the Caribbean and in the lead up to the attack on Venezuela. You obviously were not notified in advance of that attack, and we'll get to that in a moment. I just wanted to start by asking you, as someone who's followed this closely, when you heard the news, first of all, how did you hear the news? Normally, you would have heard it in a briefing before it happened, but how did you hear the news and what was your first reaction?
Yeah, I mean, I think I turned the television on or I started seeing it on social media. And, you know, it was like at 2 or 3 in the morning. I was at home in San Antonio. So I was up late because it's Christmas break for my kids. And so they were staying up late, super late. And my daughter, my 12-year-old, was still awake, so I was still awake. And I started seeing this stuff come up on X and other social media. And then I turned on, you know, the news channels and then saw some of the footage coming through. But no, I mean, you know, I'm on the Intel Committee. I'm the ranking member for Western Hemisphere on the Foreign Affairs Committee. And we got zero notice, like nothing. I mean, you know, no heads up. And the thing is, Ben, I had asked Marco Rubio when they did that briefing. They had a big briefing, you know, like on December 16th or 17th. And I asked him specifically, I said, if you guys are going to do a land strike or some kind of land invasion, are you going to come to Congress to get authorization to do it, right? What we call an AUMF. And he said, you know, we'll come to Congress for anything that requires an AUMF. But he also said, we haven't made any plans for anything like that. I mean, that obviously just wasn't true.
Well, actually, I want to stick with that for a second, because you, like me, I'm sure, watched Dan Kane at that, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, at the press conference with Trump after the operation.
Yeah.
And he basically was describing what sounded like months of planning, you know, pre-positioning all these resources. Obviously, you have to plan a complex special forces raid like that. It seemed like, and I'm sure you can't talk about this, but it seemed like there was a combination of probably offensive cyber operations and special operations. This took months. Is it not the case that they were telling you that they that they weren't planning anything while they were planning something? I mean, that seems like a big deal.
No, I mean, look, this has been, and I don't say this lightly, right? And it's not just partisan criticism, like, okay, I'm a Democrat and these guys are Republicans. I mean, this has been the most secretive, least transparent administration, certainly that I've dealt with. I mean, I've been here 13 years, but in my conversations with people that have served a lot longer, including some Republicans, no, it's the most secretive, least transparent administration. I mean, it's gotten so bad that on foreign affairs, for example, Maria Salazar from Florida, I'm the ranking member, she's the chairwoman, they didn't even want to send her a witness, have the State Department present a witness at a subcommittee hearing on Honduras when we were doing this hearing on Honduras ahead of the elections, right? I mean, you never see that, right? You never see the situation where the president from one party doesn't want to send a witness, for example, to the hearing when his own party is in the majority. I mean, that's unheard of, really. But that's where we are. It speaks to where we are right now.
Because Trump also did say on Air Force One that he spoke to American oil companies before the operation. So feels like maybe Chevron got a heads up before you did.
I guess we're just not the right people, you know? I mean, he talked to some Texans, but not me. Maybe that's what I should say.
Yeah.
You know, he was talking to the Houstonians instead of the San Antonians.
I mean, that way.
Was crazy. The idea that you'd go talk to these big oil company folks and like zero members of Congress, because even the Republicans, I think he talked to them. I think Rubio said they talked to them after the strikes were done. And then it sounds like he talked to the people that he's comfortable with, right? Because he served in the Senate. So Tom Cotton and a few others that he's friends with.
Well, it seems like everything is about you know, personal relationships now and not institutions. But well, look, to get into what's going on, what is your reaction? You know, there's been a lot to digest. Trump is now saying we're going to run Venezuela, but he's also basically keeping the Maduro regime in place, absent Maduro. He says that this is, you know, we're no longer talking about drugs as much as we're talking about oil. What are your concerns right now going forward about what happens now that the United States has removed Nicolas Maduro from power in Venezuela?
I mean, like a bunch of things for us as Americans, and then a bunch of things for Venezuela and what it means for the sovereignty of nations. For us as Americans, I mean, right now, literally right now, you have millions of Americans who are having to pay more money for their healthcare insurance because Donald Trump and the Republicans wouldn't extend these healthcare subsidies. And so, like, even my insurance went up $2,400 this year, you know, and I got diagnosed with cancer 3 years ago. And, you know, and so now I'm paying $200 more a month. That's a common story right now all over the country. So, you know, you're either going to spend billions of dollars here in the United States for Americans, or you're going to spend billions of dollars over there in Venezuela. And right now, Donald Trump is choosing to spend billions of dollars over in Venezuela. And so that's a big concern for me, is he's talking about us running and fixing the Venezuelan oil industry and all that. I mean, that's not a $500 thing, right? That's billions and billions of dollars. And for Venezuela, you've seen throughout history in Latin America and other parts of the world, you know, when you take out the leader, it can often be a very destabilizing thing. In fact, we just saw that there were like skirmishes, gunfire and so forth yesterday. And, you know, we don't know exactly what happened, if it was an attempted coup, if there's different sides that are starting to fight. So, you know, my concern for them is the destabilization. It's a country where you've already had millions of people leave to go to Colombia, to go to Chile, to come to the United States, or try to come to the United States. You know, so this, the destabilization. And then finally, you know, people are wondering, okay, well, like, what's Trump's foreign policy? Like, what's he doing? I don't think that he was necessarily acting in the best interest of the United States or even of Venezuela. Although there are a lot of Venezuelans that are happy that Maduro was gone because in many ways he did abuse his people. But I don't think that's what Trump was doing. I mean, I think that his foreign policy is basically whatever makes Trump rich at this point. I think there's like a small group of political cronies and family members that he is trying to enrich. And, you know, if we look 5 or 10 years down the road, these are some of the people that are going to have a big stake in the different Venezuelan industries, whether it's oil, natural resources like gold and ore and iron and so forth, or other things, you know, running their electrical grid and stuff. Yeah, I think that's what it's boiled down to. And I hate to say that as an American, but I think that our president, that's basically where he's at.
Yeah, you said a lot that I want to break down here. I mean, because there are different things that concern me here. So let's take one that gets at your effort to introduce a bipartisan war powers resolution that, you know, you've been working on for some time now. For people who don't know, this is essentially trying to insist that, you know, the United States return to a circumstance where the president cannot use military force without coming to Congress. That's in the Constitution.
Right.
But part of what concerns me, right, and I think other people, is that he seems to be catching this regime change bug. You know, even after the Operation Venezuela, he threatened the president of Colombia. He threatened to go into Cuba. He's talking again about Greenland. It feels like this might not be the last one. And that raises the question of what can be done to stop or slow this down. Talk a little bit about what your effort might do to at least try to insert Congress into this mix so it's harder for Trump to kind of keep running this play again and again in other countries.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, a little bit of recent background. Along with Jim McGovern and Thomas Massie, a Republican from Kentucky, the three of us led a resolution, a war powers resolution, to try to force President Trump to come to Congress, get permission if he was going to do any of this, any kind of land strikes, land invasion, so forth. And so it was a bipartisan resolution. And we even picked up a few Republicans, but we lost the vote, I think 213 to 211. We lost by two votes. It was a close vote. But you know, after that, then obviously around the new year, Donald Trump goes ahead and launches that invasion. And you're right. I mean, since then, he's just become more problematic because he's talking about, okay, we may go do Colombia. We may do Mexico. Stephen Miller's out there ranting about Greenland again. You know, and they put out this national security strategy memo that talks about the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine was basically a declaration that, you know, the world's power is going to protect certain spheres of their territorial backyard. And so for the United States, that included the Western Hemisphere and Latin America. But, you know, it was that policy for years, particularly during the Cold War, that saw the United States do essentially this. They treated every right-wing leader as a friend and every left-wing leader as a foe, fearing that communism through these left-wing presidents was going to lead to, you know, the Red Scare across the Western Hemisphere. So we backed some really bad people. I mean, we backed Pinochet. We backed folks in Central America and South America that abused their people, committed all kinds of human rights abuses. You know, so when you talk about, like, he's talking about the Monroe Doctrine and going back to that, you're talking about going back to a policy that's decades old that led to many people getting killed, a mass migration, civil war, all of these things. But to answer your question, beyond the Venezuela War Powers Resolution, which we're going to refile soon, I think that you'll also see other resolutions with respect to Greenland, similar resolutions with respect to Greenland, Mexico, Colombia, and so forth.
Yeah. And well, there's another piece of this that I was wondering about too, which is the war powers would try to constrain his capacity to do this, at least without Congress. You mentioned the billions of dollars it would cost to do what he's talking about doing in Venezuela. Like, that oil infrastructure is dilapidated. It's fallen into disrepair.
Yeah.
It's a multi-billion dollar.
Yeah.
Where's that money going to come from? Like, I remember being in the White House,
voting for that. So I don't
know. Well, that's the question, though. Do you have any, because even this operation and all these deployments must cost money. I mean, is there some capacity for Congress to try to figure out using its power, the purse, although I know the Republicans have kind of, you know, relinquished that. But what about the his ability to pay for, say, the reconstruction of Venezuela's oil industry?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like you ask a great question, I mean, where would it come from? Well, in theory, right, it's going to come from the taxpayers. American taxpayers are going to have to pay these hundreds of billions of dollars. And remember, like he's talking about, I've seen the figure about like $115 billion just for the oil industry in Venezuela. But you're talking about Colombia, you're talking about Greenland, maybe Mexico. He threatened Panama over the canal issues. So, I mean, that $115 billion is for one industry in one country. If you go do all these countries, you're definitely talking about trillions of dollars. And yeah, I don't see the Congress supporting that. So I don't know. I don't think they have a real plan. I don't even think they have a real plan for Venezuela. I mean, I think they're just, it's just kind of, you know, fly by night stuff at this point. And just a lot of talk, but obviously a lot of swagger, but a lot of, you know, dangerous action as well.
It feels that way. And I want to ask about both parties and their response to this. So we'll start with the Democrats, which, you know, generally I think Democrats have been quite strong on this in opposing what is clearly an illegal, reckless, dangerous action that has nothing to do with, as you said, you know, dealing with affordability and the kinds of things that Americans care about. But you always sense in these moments, particularly when the military is involved and there's an operation like this, there's always a little bit of tentativeness. And you had an Axios report the other day where they quoted some anonymous centrist colleagues of yours who were saying, you know, that I think it looks weak, one person said, to criticize Trump. If you don't acknowledge this as a win for our country, then you lose credibility. How unified is the party on this? And would you like to see more, you know, kind of more voices raised against this? Are you concerned about that kind of post 9/11 mindset that, oh, we're afraid of looking weak if we criticize this? I mean, what is your sense of where Democrats are on this?
I think that we're still pretty united. Obviously, I think we're going to find out a bit more in the next few weeks. But my sense is that Democrats are still united against it. I do think, you know, when you see the U.S. military and how swiftly and effectively they were able to carry out this operation, look, I think that there is a lot of American pride in having a strong and successful military that can carry out an operation. But I also think that's separate from the wisdom of taking on the operation and the commander in chief, the president, who made the decision to go do it. And so I think ultimately people will support those war power resolutions, Democrats especially, and hopefully we'll pick up some Republicans as well. Because, you know, like I said, you know, Venezuela may not be the last. It looks like it may be the first, right? For years, they've been laying the groundwork. I've been saying for years that they've been laying the groundwork to take military action in Mexico. In fact, there was an AUMF that was proposed by one of the Republicans in Congress, even a few years ago, reclassifying fentanyl, for example, like all of these different steps, designating some of the cartels as terrorists that would then justify the president, Donald Trump, basically declaring some kind of war or taking military action. I'm hoping we're going to stay united, but we're going to see in the next few weeks.
Well, and I also want to ask about Republicans. You have worked with Thomas Massie, a Republican from Kentucky. He's been willing to break with Trump on a number of things on your war powers resolution. It strikes me that this is kind of the opposite of what Trump promised his MAGA base, right? Ending forever wars was a key part of his attraction to a lot of people who are exhausted by spending money or deployments overseas. In talking to Republicans, maybe who still, you know, feel like they have to say nice things about Trump in public, do you have any sense that MAGA base is cracking a little bit? Because you see it among the kind of MAGA commentariat. But is there an opportunity for Democrats to reach different voters or even maybe different colleagues of yours who don't like this kind of imperial foreign policy?
Absolutely, yes, because I think for a lot of them in their minds, they're having to do a 180 because remember, they got behind Trump as the peace president. I mean, he went after Jeb Bush hard, remember, in 2016, basically held all of the George W. Bush actions with respect to Iraq and Afghanistan against Jeb Bush, successfully, by the way, and even took on Hillary Clinton with the same argument, right? I mean, there were newspaper articles and columns even speculating about whether Donald Trump was more of a dove than Hillary Clinton back in 2016. He criticized Biden along the same lines in their contest in 2020. So a lot of his base is having to do this 180. A lot of them are doing that 180. They're coming along with him, right? But there's some that I can see, and even a few folks that I've talked to who are like, it's kind of like their eyebrows are raised, right? Like they're confused. Well, wait a minute. I thought we stood for the other thing, like not globalism, not intervention, you know, the U.S. minding its own business, not being the policeman of the world, and so forth. But you know, I think Donald Trump, for him at least, I don't think he cares anymore. I don't think he cares what happens to the Republican Party either, really. I do think, you know, in his perfect world, Democrats wouldn't take back the House or the Senate because he doesn't want any oversight, doesn't want any investigations, doesn't want subpoenas, all that. But otherwise, man, I just think he's like, you know, he's doing his own thing. I think when the Supreme Court made that decision about a president not being liable criminally for official acts, to him, that was just like taking the guardrails off. You know, as long as it's an official act, he can do whatever he wants. And then you've got people like Stephen Miller out there, who I think is unstable himself, who are making like key decisions on this. Yeah, it's just a bad mix for the country.
Well, yeah, and one more thing I want to ask you, which is, I know it's early days after this and people are digesting it, but you were in at home when this happened. Have you gotten any sense of how this is going down with your constituents? You know, how this might factor into the case that you'll be making next year about whether Trump is doing what he's elected to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think most people at the beginning, they were like, why? Like, why are we doing this? Why is the country doing this? But then I think San Antonio is known as, that the place I represent is known as Military City USA. So we still have a huge military installation there in Joint Base San Antonio, and we have a huge number of veterans there. So, you know, you have people in those neighborhoods, just like across America, that sent their kids off to war and never saw them come home. So every time there is something like this, where there may be a war, troops may get deployed, I get calls and we get emails and everything from people that are basically really nervous, usually family members, spouses, parents that are really nervous, like, hey, what are you guys doing? What's going on? And it was the same thing this time. A lot of outreach, you know. And so I sent a mass email to thousands of people saying, hey, this is what's happening. This is what I'm trying to prevent, which is, you know, getting into this thing further or then going to Mexico and Colombia and so forth. But no, people are confused and increasingly getting angry about this whole thing.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too, because part of the Western Hemisphere piece of this is also that you have, first and foremost, that concern of troop deployments again and the risk that could pose to our troops. You have the concern about, why are we doing this again? We're spending money over there instead of fixing the affordability crisis here. But also, these are, because it's closer to home, all these countries he's threatening, they're huge diaspora populations in this country. Now, the Venezuelans had mixed, you know, some of them were happy to see Maduro gone, although I think they're surprised to learn that the Maduro regime is staying in place. That's a whole other question. But you know, Mexico, right? He's talking about bombing Mexico. There are a lot of people with family in Mexico. He's talking about bombing Colombia. There are a lot of people with family in Colombia. Do you have any sense of how the kind of diaspora populations are digesting the fact that, you know, Latin America could become this kind of roaming war zone for the United States?
Yeah, I've seen this, or I've heard this in conversations with Venezuelans who are in the United States that have family members that are still in Caracas, for example. And then certainly, like, in the conversations about what he may do in Mexico, they're worried for their family members, right? They're worried about the danger that it may present to their family members. And, you know, let's just take Mexico, for example, right? So he's talked about cartel strikes. Well, how about we'll take on the cartels? But it's not just that, right? If you do that, it's likely that the cartels are also going to take action either against Americans, but I think more likely against Mexican politicians, against other Mexican citizens, that they're going to make life hell for others in Mexico, right? So it'll create a kind of, you know, basically huge danger and disruption there. And I think that's also what people are worried about is, are my relatives, is my family going to be safe?
Yeah. Well, that's a scary but important note to end on, because we feels like we're kind of in the early stages of something, unfortunately. Joaquin Castro, we wish you the best with your work, particularly on this War Powers resolution. People should, people want to get involved and do something, call your member of Congress, encourage them to support the War Powers resolution, to support the return of constitutional powers to Congress. We'll be watching your work and hoping that the Spurs get back to the finals where they can lose to the Knicks.
Spurs-Knicks again.
Yeah. Spurs-Knicks. We'll hope for a replay of the NBA Cup. Thanks so much for joining us.
Take care.
Thanks again to Congressman Castro for joining the show. Ben, thank you for playing through your flu game. I hope you feel better. And, you know, talk to you guys soon. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Alona Minkowski. Our associate producer is Michael Goldsmith. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, and Ben Rhodes. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Jordan Cantor is our audio engineer. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Thanks to our digital team, Ben Hefcoat, Mia Kelman, William Jones, David Tolles, and Ryan Young. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Adrian Hill is our senior vice president of news and politics. If you want to listen to Pod Save the World ad-free and get access to exclusive podcasts, go to crooked.com/friends to subscribe on Supercast, Substack, YouTube, or Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events. Plus, find Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and much more. And if, like us, you're opinionated, leave us a review. Our production staff is proudly unionized by the Writers Guild of America East. If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.